Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 268 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the Clean SP curriculum for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam and also Step 3. I mean, basically, I'm sure many of you are well aware that there are changes coming down to the USMLE exams starting November 11th. And I essentially plan to cover all those new topics according to the USMLE content outline. So far, I've made three of those. I call it the Clean SP curriculum, right? So Clean SP, there's Clean SP 1, there's Clean SP 2, and there's Clean SP 3. So I would highly encourage you to consider looking through those podcasts, especially if you're going to be taking the exam right around, after November 11th. Although I won't be surprised if the USMLE has already started testing a lot of this information, right? And the thing about the Clean SP, right? So if you want to know exactly which episode is what, right? So episode 228, right, is Clean SP 1. Episode 230 is Clean SP 2. Episode 234 is Clean SP 3. So episode 268 is Clean SP 4. Again, it's almost, there are some things I've mentioned before that I'm going to be mentioning here, but I just wanted to kind of put it all together in one podcast and just reiterate and, you know, probably better explain certain things. So basically, this podcast is going to be focused on palliative care. And as a reminder, if you're taking Step 2 CK anytime soon, I'm offering an MBME test taking strategies class. It's also very useful for Step 3. I'm offering that this Friday from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time via Zoom. And then I have a 10-hour Step 2 CK class taking place this Saturday, the 17th of October. We're going to go from 6 to 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then we'll take a 2-hour break. And then from noon to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, we'll take a 2-hour break. And then from 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, right? And then we'll be done. And we'll pretty much go over about 800 concepts cut across like internal medicine, peds, surgery, OB-GYN, neuro and psych. So if you're interested in that, just hit the contact button on the website, shoot me an email, and I'll point you out in the right direction. Okay, so let's get right into it, right? So we're going to be talking again, like I said, about palliative care. Again, I've kind of started that topic in episode 228. That's the first Clean SP podcast. Remember, the second one is episode 230, third one is episode 234. But here in episode 268, again, I'm going to be saying some more things about palliative care. Because again, I want to be as complete as possible with these. And again, any bit of repetition also helps, right? So palliative care, right? So again, what is palliative care, right? Palliative care is basically something you do to people that are very ill, right? So these people are seriously ill. And the thing is, when you're trying to administer palliative care, you're not just doing it for the well-being of the patient. You're actually doing it for the well-being of their families as well, right? And the thing is, one misconception about palliative care that, again, your friends at the MBME will care that you know, is that palliative care is not something you do, I'm doing it just because the person is sick, or, I think this person is going to die kind of deal. No, you can actually do palliative care at any stage in a person's illness, right? And even if the person is currently being treated with the goal that, this person is going to be cured, it doesn't matter, right? Palliative care is still an ideal thing in those people, right? In fact, that's why there is palliative care fellowships in this day and age, right? And really, there is no like age you have to hit to be eligible for palliative care. Even in the pediatric population, there can be palliative care in the pediatric population, right? Now, let's talk about some palliative care documents that, again, are commonly tested on exams, right? So the thing is, before we even get into those documents, because this is kind of like a nice segue, right? Before you start giving the person documents and telling them to fill out one form or the other, right? What are you typically supposed to do? Typically, what you're supposed to do first, right, is to try to figure out what are these patients' values? What are these patients' preferences, right? So, like, what does this patient want, essentially, right? And then once you figure those things out, once the patient communicates those things to you, you can then begin to try out these different documents or have them fill out these different documents. The first big document you want to keep at the back of your mind for these USMLE exams is a living will, right? So remember, a living will basically, it's a patient that pretty much directs that, right? So the living will, the patient says, okay, they will talk about like the extent to which, you know, they're looking for like life-sustaining treatment, right? And especially if they become like, you know, like very ill, or they go into like a vegetative state, right? Essentially, it's basically like the patient spelling out, these are the life-saving measures that should be done, or these are the life-saving measures I do not want being done when I'm in a state where I am incapacitated and unable to make decisions, right? So that's a living will. And I'll try to make some clear distinctions between living wills and other stuff that I'm going to be talking about, right? And then a durable healthcare power of attorney, right, is basically a legal document where you essentially designate someone, right? And that person that you designate, right, is going to be the one making healthcare decisions for you, right? And one critical difference I will say from the get-go between a living will and a durable healthcare power of attorney is basically a living will essentially focuses on interventions that either in like deal with like withholding care or withdrawing like, you know, like life-sustaining interventions, right? But the thing is, people that have that durable healthcare power of attorney, they actually have a lot more power, right? They have a lot more power. Like, they have like much broader scopes in the kinds of decisions that they can make, right? And then one other thing you may see, and this is something that they can make an ICU question on your exam. They can talk about a person that has COVID or something like that, right? And then they'll tell you about like, oh, like a physician, like trying to like create order sets. You know, the physician basically like talks things over with the patient, like, or like orders where like, oh, okay, what should we do for in this situation? What should we do in that situation? Blah, 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 blah. Like, oh, you know, you came in with COVID, you're having worsening symptoms. What would you like us to do if XYZ were to happen, right? When a physician is basically going over those order sets with a patient or the healthcare power of attorney, that's actually something that is known as a POLST, right? So they are called, it's basically like POLST, P-O-L-S-T means like physician orders, right? For life-sustaining care. Sorry, for life-sustaining treatment, right? So a POLST is basically, it deals with how the patient is currently doing right now, not like some hypothetical situation in the future. And then you're like, oh, based on your health, based on your COVID-19 status, your declining oxygen requirements, let's go over some other sets as to what should be done and what should not be done, right? But a living will, on the other hand, tends to focus more on like future situations that are hypothetical, that may not even happen, right? But again, a POLST form is based on, oh, this is exactly how this person is feeling right here, right now, right? So again, the big thing you just want to keep in mind is you're doing all these advanced care planning just again in case the patient becomes incapacitated so that you can make decisions that are consistent with their values and their preferences. And if a patient has living, this is a classic USMLE question, right? So if a patient has written a living will or has a durable healthcare power of attorney, right? Or has gone over like a POLST form with a physician, but the patient is still lucid, right? And the patient is still able to make their own decisions. The patient's own decisions supersede all this other stuff. Supersedes the POLST, supersedes the durable healthcare power of attorney, supersedes the living will. Okay? It's just one of those key critical things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? And then when a person is going through palliative care, right, there are some key classic symptoms you want to be able to manage, right? So if, for example, a person is going through, you know, like, these are like classic end of life things, essentially, right? Like if a person is going through a lot of pain, right? One thing you want to keep in mind is, especially again, if a person has like terminal illness or whatever, there is actually something that has been released by the WHO. Again, that because I'm sure you've seen some of these NBME questions where they'll talk about like the DASH diet, like just like some interventions that are like going with like some organization or something, right? Like some of those alcohol screening tools or some depression screening tools that they test on exams. You'd want to know that in palliative care, right, one thing that's commonly used, especially on the USMLEs, to screen, to basically manage a person's pain in palliative care, right, is the three-step analgesic ladder, right? So it's from the WHO, it's called the three-step analgesic ladder. Basically, it's like a pain scale, right? Like you basically rate pain from mild, being like a pain score of like 1 to 3, moderate, which is like a pain score of like 4 to 6, right? And then severe pain, which is scores from like 7 to 10, right? So just start from 1 to 3, 4 to 6, 7 to 10, right? And basically, if a person has mild pain, from this WHO analgesic ladder, for the most part, those people, you just give them like a pain reliever that is not opioid based, right? So something like acetaminophen, or you can give an NSAID, you can give aspirin, stuff like that, right? But then if a person has moderate pain, right, then you need to begin to use opioids, right? Basically, you start opioids for moderate pain. And you do that on a, you know, like a small dose, right? But if a person is having like very severe pain, right, in general, you then need to go with really big doses of opioids. You may need to combine multiple opioids to try to control those people's pain. And one thing I would want you to just keep at the back of your mind is that when a person has metastatic disease, right, it's a classic MBMA scenario, metastatic disease, really severe pain, really severe symptoms, if their opioids are not coordinate for pain, either increase the dose, right, at least titrate it till they don't have like side effects from the opioid, right, or increase the frequency, right? That's a very important key point to know. You can increase the frequency of the opioids that they are getting, right? And then there are some weird specific scenarios that the MBMA wants you to keep in mind with regards to like some specific diseases and how you treat the pain associated with them, right? So say, for example, a person has like metastatic disease, right, to like the bone, and they're getting like a lot of fractures from those bone mets, right? To help those people with pain, sometimes the MBMA will give you a question and you won't put opioids or anything. For those people, actually, giving bisphosphonates, giving calcitonin is actually ideal in those circumstances, right? So you can give bisphosphonates, you can give calcitonin, works pretty well in those circumstances, right? Or let's say they tell you about a person that, you know, has like a malignancy that has metastasized to the bowel, right? Or primary bowel malignancy like colon cancer that's obstructing the bowel, or stomach cancer that's obstructing the stomach, right? Or sometimes, you know, melanomas love to metastasize to the small bowel as well, right? Like if a person has like malignancy that's like basically obstructing the GI tract, right? For those people, actually giving an anticholinergic agent, right, can actually help, right? Like a classic one you may see on exams is glycopyrrolate. Glycopyrrolate is a muscarinic receptor antagonist, right? So you can use that to your benefits to help with the pain associated with a person having like a bowel malignancy. Although one thing you'd have to be careful with that is that can also mess up the person's GI motility and cause a lot of problems, right? Almost in a sense, those things are making your bowel not work. If your bowel is not contracting, then you will not be contracting against that resistance, which is the obstruction from the malignancy, right? And then remember, if a person has like neuropathic pain, again from meds, again you can give them like an agent, right, that can help with neuropathic pain, like gabapentin. You can give a pregabalin, stuff like that, right? Or if a person has pain, right, from a tumor, like a tumor that is infiltrating like nerves, right, or compressing the spinal cord, steroids can help with pain in those circumstances, right? Like, so say for example, a person has a malignancy that's like, let's say like it's a lung cancer and it's causing severe pain, right? Or let's say it's like a pancreas tumor that is beginning to infiltrate the brachial plexus, and then they're trying to treat those people for like their pain. The drug of choice in that circumstance will be a steroid, right? Steroids really help in those circumstances, right? So we've dealt with pain as one of these end of life symptoms that people can have, right? And then with regards to just being short of breath, right? Remember, when people have cancer, I mean, like, this is one of those things about the ICU. The ICU can be, I mean, I've worked in an ICU and I absolutely enjoy working in the ICU. It's a fun place to work in. But I'll say, you know, the ICU is also mentally and emotionally draining. I'll tell you that right now. When you see people at the point of death, you know, when you're like holding them in your arms, you know, for their last breath, they are very short of breath. They're like, they're literally just gasping for life, right? When a person has shortness of breath, right, or again, the $5 word for that will be dyspnea, right? There are certain things you can do, right? First things first, the drug of choice is going to be an opioid, right? Opioids are the drugs of choice for treating dyspnea in a person that has a malignancy, right? And I mean, you may say, okay, Divine, like, why do opioids help? Well, the thing is, opioids, especially morphine, if they give you multiple opioids on your exam to pick for dyspnea, pick morphine as the first one you'd want to go with, right? And one of the reasons that opioids help, actually, there's a few mechanistic reasons. The thing is, opioids, right, they kind of depress a person's respiration in a sense, right? So your oxygen consumption is not as great when a person is on opioids, right? So, you know, if you're short of breath, it means you're gasping for oxygen. Well, if you decrease the person's need for oxygen, then they may not be gasping for it as much anymore, right? And then another thing is opioids, they actually also dilate your pulmonary vessels, right? So because they are very good at dilating your pulmonary vessels, right? Again, they can basically increase a person's oxygen delivery around the body in a sense, right? And then remember, when a person is hypoxic, again, the body responds by hyperventilating, right? Like if a person's CO2 begins to build up, right? Or they become super hypoxic, their O2 goes down, they begin to hyperventilate. Opioids basically numb that response, right? So they make you not as hyper responsive to like hypoxia or hypercapnia, right? So those are the reasons, those are the mechanistic reasons behind why opioids help in a person that has a dyspnea in terminal disease, right? And again, they can give you some very, very weird specific scenarios on your exam, right? Like, for example, if a person has like a lung cancer that is obstructing the airway, right? Like obstructing like a bronchus or something, right? If they are asking you for ways to treat their dyspnea, you want to go ahead and pick the answer choice that says to stent those people's airways, right? To stent those people's airways. You basically insert a stent. You're essentially like widening out the airway so that those people can breathe better, right? Or let's say, for example, a person has like a malignancy, especially lung cancer or mesothelioma, right? That's building up like a big time pleural effusion. For those people, you want to go ahead and perform a thoracentesis, right? You want to perform a thoracentesis so that you can, again, consistently drain that malignant fluid that's building up. You usually like insert some kind of catheter so that, again, they can consistently drain. Another classic scenario you may see on your exam with that regard is, what is this thing called? If a person has like pancreatic cancer, and that pancreatic cancer is, it's like encasing the pancreatic duct, and those people are having like very severe pain. Again, you can stent those people's pancreatic ducts. It actually helps with the pain. It actually helps with the itching. It just helps with, it doesn't improve life. I mean, it doesn't like improve survival, but it actually helps those people's quality of life, right? So that's how you deal with dyspnea, right? You deal with shortness of breath. Now, in terms of nausea, right? So if a person is nauseous, usually these are people that are undergoing chemotherapy. Nausea, for the most part, there's a bunch of things you can use. I mean, the big one is ondansetron, right? You can use ondansetron. It's a serotonin receptor antagonist, right? Because remember, there's a lot of serotonin receptors in the chemoreceptor trigger zone, right? That can cause a lot of problems, right? So if you block those serotonin receptors, right, then you can essentially help with nausea. It's like the drug of choice. Also, if you don't see that, right, don't forget there are other drugs like metoclopramide, right? Metoclopramide actually, you know, it's a dopamine receptor antagonist, right? But it's also, it's a very good prokinetic agent. But one other thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that, again, it's very good for nausea, right? In the setting of like terminal disease, in the setting of malignancy. And don't forget though, because metoclopramide blocks dopamine receptors, your friends at the NBME can be very good and prudent at essentially making it a psych question, right? So they can talk about a person that is in palliative care, right? And the person is getting a drug for nausea and vomiting, right? And then they tell you that this person, you know, develops like a leukocytosis, develops a very high fever, develops muscle rigidity. If you see that, I would really hope that you're thinking about like neuroleptic malignant syndrome, right? And remember, for that, those people, you want to go ahead and give them dantrolene, right? Dantrolene is the drug of choice for neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Remember, dantrolene is a ryanodine receptor antagonist, right? So by blocking those ryanodine receptors, it's essentially a calcium channel blocker, because the ryanodine receptor is a calcium channel, right? So it's a calcium channel blocker, and by blocking those calcium channels, it'll prevent you from releasing that calcium, right, from the sarcoplasmic reticulum of the muscle, so that that can kind of dumb down that muscle contraction, right? And remember, your friends at the NBME, just like the classic brilliant way they test these complications of disease, right, they can ask you which of the following is the most likely renal complication, right, or the most adverse renal complication of neuroleptic malignant syndrome. In that case, they are going after rhabdomyolysis, right, because all that muscle breakdown, that myoglobin will go and torch the person's kidneys, cause an intrarenal acute kidney injury, cause acute tubular necrosis, right? And then that will cause a lot of problems, right? And remember, when a person has rhabdo, right? Remember, you'll see a lot of blood by urinalysis, right? But you won't see, you'll have almost no red blood cells by urine microscopy. And again, as I've said in many podcasts, they're not going to test this by saying, oh, urinalysis shows a lot of blood, but urine microscopy shows no red blood cells, right? That's ridiculous. Again, this is one of the reasons why flashcards are not always the most helpful things for for exams, right? You can memorize all the buzzwords you want. It's not really going to help you on these newer MBME exams. You actually need to understand, like, what in the world do these buzzwords mean, right? So, like, the classic thing the MBME will do is they'll give you your analysis results, and then they'll put, like, blood 4+, right? And then they'll put red blood cells 0 to 2 per high power field, or 0 to 1 per high power field. That makes no sense, right? That's like, that's almost like the albuminocytologic dissociation of the urine, right? In a sense, right? So it's almost like a blood, red blood cell dissociation of the urine, right? I'll explain what I mean. I know some of you may be like, what is Divine talking about? Just hang on, right? So, because if you're seeing 4+ blood, you should be seeing like tens and hundreds of red blood cells by high power field, right? But if you're seeing like 4+ blood and you're seeing only like 0 to 2, 0 to 3 red blood cells per high power field, that makes absolutely no sense, right? So there's almost a dissociation between the amount of blood you're seeing and the actual amount of red blood cells you're seeing, right? That's what you find in rhabdomyolysis, right? So remember, albuminocytologic dissociation, it's a famous CSF finding in a person that has a Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? The thing is, that albumin, remember, albumin is a protein in the body, right? And then cytologic means cells. Whenever you see very high protein in a person's CSF, you should see a ton of white blood cells, right? So let's say you're seeing a ton of protein, you should be able to see like, oh, like 30, 50, 100 white blood cells per high power field. But if you're seeing a ton of protein, right? And then you're seeing like, wow, like 0 to 2 red white blood cells per high power field. Again, that makes no sense, right? That makes no sense. Whenever you see stuff like that, right? You absolutely want to think about Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? So a similar dissociation happens in a person that has rhabdomyolysis, but it's more of a urinary finding. And the dissociation is between the amount of blood you're seeing by urinalysis and the amount of red blood cells you're seeing by urine microscopy. And then you may be like, why is the Divine spending 2 or 3 minutes talking about this stuff? I've seen this on exams personally, and this shows up on exams a lot, that you want to make sure you know these things, right? So we've talked about ondansetron, it's a serotonin receptor antagonist. We've talked about metoclopramide, dopamine receptor antagonist, right? And also don't forget this drug, aprepitant. So it's spelled as aprepitant, right? Aprepitant. Aprepitant is basically like an antagonist at receptors called neurokinin receptors, right? It's actually a pretty powerful anti-nausea medication. Again, it's one of these things you may see in a palliative care question on exams, right? So again, don't forget your ondansetron, don't forget your metoclopramide, and don't forget aprepitant, right? Just remember like the term OMA, like a maltoma, right? Just remember this as an OMA, right? So O for ondansetron, and notice all these things are antagonists, right? So ondansetron, antagonist at serotonin receptors, metoclopramide, antagonist at dopamine receptors, aprepitant, antagonist at neurokinin 1, NK1 receptors. It's an NK1 receptor antagonist, okay? And then again, if a person has nausea because, again, they have like a bowel malignancy that's causing obstruction or whatever, you can actually give those people steroids, right? Because again, the big thing with steroids, maybe like Divine, why are we giving steroids for all these people? Steroids are amazing at cutting down on edema, right? And when they cut down on edema, that will relieve obstruction, right? That will relieve obstruction, right? It basically almost like cools down the tumor in a bit, right? So that all that edema does not keep causing bowel obstruction, right? And then remember, a person that also has malignancy, because they're taking so many, like if the person has like malignancy pain, those people tend to be taking a ton of opioids, right? Those opioids, right, can cause, they can cause a lot of constipation, right? So constipation is another classic thing you may find in a person that, in a palliative care question on an MBME exam, right? So basically, right, those people will have like a decrease in frequency of their stool, right? So how can we help these people? The thing is, if you're trying to, let me tell you this. There is such a thing as prophylaxis against constipation, and there is such a thing as treatment for constipation, right? I know you may be like, Divine, why is Divine making a big deal about these salient differences? I promise you, I would not be making these salient difference discussions if it was not high yield to know, right? So this is actually one of those places where you actually want to kind of pay attention, right? That you want to pay attention here. So the thing is, if you're trying to prophylax against constipation, the classic agent you want to use on an MBME exam is to give like a laxative that's like a stimulant, right? Like Senna, right? Senna is S-E-N-N-A, right? You can use that as prophylaxis. You can use that as prevention, right? So even clinically, right, when you're studying a person on an opioid, it probably makes sense to just put them on a smidge of Senna, right? Now, after a person actually has constipation, well, what can we use to treat those people, right? Well, one thing we can do is we can give people like agents that can make their stool like bulky, right? Like, for example, you can give like methyl cellulose, you can give psyllium. Psyllium is psylium, right? But again, remember, you need to be taking a ton of fluid for these bulking agents to work, right? If you're not taking a lot of fluid, if your stool is bulky but hard, that's not very helpful, right? So your stool needs to be bulky and be able to pass, right? And then another thing is you can also use a polyethylene glycol, right? So remember, polyethylene glycol is not reabsorbable in the GI tract, right? So it's very good at, you know, taking fluid in, right? And then you poop out, right? And then don't forget lactulose, right? So lactulose is not just used on NBM exams for hepatic encephalopathy, right? With those with the hyperammonemia, lactulose also helps in many, many other ways, right? You can actually use it for treatment of constipation, right? Those people will go to the bathroom like a lot, right? This is one of the joys of treating people that have end-stage liver disease, right? So you give those people lactulose, right? Again, lactulose is a sugar. It's not digestible, right? But first things first, it's very osmotic, right? So it attracts a lot of water, right? And then the second thing is it also promotes the growth of microbes in your GI tract, right? Whenever people have a stomach bug, right? Stomach bugs cause problems, right? Many times when a person has gastroenteritis, they're going to have diarrhea with it, right? So basically that lactulose is almost like you're organizing Thanksgiving, right? For bugs in the person's GI tract. As you organize that Thanksgiving, they're going to have a wonderful time, right? They're going to eat, but you're going to be fettered essentially to the bathroom at that point, right? And then one other drug you may see on exams is this drug known as methylnaltrexone. It's actually a drug that is now being used actually to treat like if a person is on opioids, right? And they have like really bad constipation, you can use methylnaltrexone. Methylnaltrexone, as you should be able to tell from the name, is a mu receptor antagonist, right? So it's basically reversing the effects of those opioids, right? So it's, you know, pretty helpful in those circumstances. Now, one thing I would just go ahead and say is if a person is these drugs, right, that cause that help your GI tract to go, want to remember that if a person has like a high-grade bowel obstruction, you don't want to put a person on these drugs, right? Because again, you can induce like a peritonitis. You can use like a rupture of the person's peritoneal cavity or something, right? So just be careful, right? They can throw that in as a small wrinkle to try to see if you fall for that bit, right? So want to be careful with that. Usually, when people have like a high grade obstruction, right, but you need their bowels to go, then one thing you can do is you can begin to use mechanical means, right? Like if it's a small bowel obstruction, you can consider doing stuff like an NG tube, right, connected to wall suction. If it's a large bowel obstruction, right, like something you may find in a person that has like a sigmoid volvulus or something like that, right, you can basically do like a sigmoidoscopy, place a rectal tube, right, and attach it to the wall, right? You're literally like suctioning those people's large bowel, right? Just something to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? Now, another classic symptom you may see in palliative care, right, is a person just being anorexic, right, and cachexic, right? So this person is essentially not eating, right? So basically for these people, you know, they're losing a lot of skeletal muscle mass, right? And give them all the nutritional support you want. Those people are not really dealing with those nutrients. For the most part, the two big things that cause those problems, one is TNF-alpha, right? TNF-alpha is a pro-inflammatory cytokine, right? They can cause all those problems, right? But also, those people, as people get towards the end of life, they begin to have like abnormal metabolism of like energy products, right? So those are the things that ultimately give rise to a person being like cachexic and anorexic. So the thing is, if a person is anorexic, again, if you want to treat those people, right, typically on NBM exams, you want to go ahead and, again, people that, again, end of life care, right, you want to consider giving those people, especially from cancer, right, you want to give them a progestin analog, right? Again, can give them something like megestrol. You can even give them like medroxyprogesterone, right? You can give them medroxyprogesterone. I mean, some of you may wonder, why does birth control cause people to, in some cases, cause people to gain weight? It's because those things are very powerful stimulants of a person's appetite, right? And again, if you don't see those things on exams, you can also give just straight up steroids. Steroids are pretty good for those indications, right? And then don't forget dronabinol. Dronabinol is a synthetic marijuana, basically, right? It's a synthetic cannabinoid. It can help in those circumstances, right? And then the final thing I think I would mention here is I guess hospice, right? Hospice, the big thing you want to know about hospice is if a person's life expectancy is less than 6 months, right, then those people should be placed in hospice. And you can do hospice at home. You can do hospice in the hospital, in a nursing facility or whatever. Basically, you can do hospice where the patient lives in general, right? It's not a big deal, right? And remember, unlike palliative care, where you can be getting palliative care, and the goal is that, a person can be getting palliative care if they're about to die, but a person can also be getting palliative care if they are being treated with the goal of cure, right? Palliative care doesn't mean, oh, we're giving you this because you're going to die. You get palliative care because you have a serious illness. That's actually how you ought to know. The thing that makes you eligible for palliative care is serious illness, right? If you have a cough and a cold, you probably should not be getting palliative care as a result of that, right? But hospice, the goal is not cure, right? You just want to make the person comfortable, right? So essentially, before a person checks into hospice, they need to essentially agree to only getting treatments that focuses on those people on managing their symptoms, right? You're not trying to cure. You're not trying to improve survival or anything. No, you're just trying to manage their symptoms and, again, make them as comfortable as possible, right? Now, so that's pretty much the end of what I want to discuss today. The big thing I will just say is please subscribe to the YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE podcast and videos. And again, any little bit of support helps. And then if you can, these podcasts, at least the most recent 150, are on Apple Podcasts, are on Spotify, are on Google Play. Please subscribe to those. Although I think Google Play is now Google Podcasts, right? So please subscribe. If you're looking for all the earlier podcasts from like episode one, then you'd have to go on the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, to get those. And actually, if you subscribe to the podcast website, again, divineinterventionpodcast.com, when I make a new podcast, you will get an email notification, which is kind of nice, right? I would love to put all the podcasts on these podcast apps, but it's a WordPress room. You can look it up. You basically cannot put more than the most recent 150 podcasts, right? So basically, when I upload this podcast, then the oldest 150th podcast will then get off of these podcast apps, right? So again, sadly, right? But that's kind of like the case with WordPress these days. It's just a WordPress rule, so not much I can do there. And then I want to talk about a life lesson today, right? And my life lesson for today is on the importance of being a spreader of good news, okay? The importance of being a spreader of good news. Right? The importance of being a spreader of good news. And actually, before I say that, again, if you need help with your ERAS application or with interview prep or with your personal statements, reach out to me again as well. I can give you some more information on pricing. So be a spreader of good news. So what do I mean by be a spreader of good news? Let me give you again, I know most of you that listen to this podcast, right, are medical students or, you know, physicians and stuff like that, right? So what I mean by be a spreader of good news? I'll give you an example, right? You see people post on Reddit, I just walked out of the exam. I feel like I failed. I feel like I was guessing on every question. Blah, 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 blah. Is the way you're feeling wrong? No, it's not. It's really not, right? It's really not. But are you doing people good by posting those things? I will argue that you're not, right? I will really argue that you're not. And the thing is, when you post those kinds of things, people that are preparing for the exam or about to take it, you essentially kill their spirits when you post those kinds of things, right? That is why, after you've taken these exams, keep a calm spirit. Sometimes it may even mean not talking to... you can talk to like a close friend, a close confidant, right? But kind of posting these things online just really, really tortures some people's minds, right? And the thing I always like saying is that mental health and wellness is a collective effort, right? It's a collective effort. I mean, personally, I believe that many people in med school administration don't do enough. They actually do a pretty crappy job, right? Like these wellness lectures, like a lecture is going to make someone mentally well all of a sudden. Those things really don't help, right? But if whoever at the top, as those people are still trying to figure out things, right? On our own, we can collectively try to ensure the wellness of our colleagues, of our friends, right? So again, I will encourage you, like, stop spreading that information. I know you feel terrible, but maybe speak to someone about it instead of just posting it online. Again, this is one of the reasons why I tell people, when you're studying for these exams, just stay off of Reddit and stay off of what is it called, SDN, right? Because again, I'm not saying this to be trash those websites. No, I'm a big time Reddit person. I'm a big time SDN person. I use both things extensively, so I'm encouraging you to use those things, right? But maybe use the parts of those websites that don't deal with exams, or like people's test experiences when you're just finished a test or you're studying for a test. One other thing you can do, which is again my preferred approach, is months before you know you're going to be taking your exam, you can copy experiences and put in a Word document positive experiences of people, like, oh, the test wasn't that bad, you know, I did XYZ, I got a 270, blah, 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 right? And then whenever you're feeling down, whenever you're feeling scared, go and read those positive experiences. Because again, like, all this just spreading bad news just really freaks yourself out, one, and it also freaks other people out too, right? And it can disturb their mental wellness, right? I mean, again, I'm not going to mention any specific news channels, right? But these days, I almost never watch the news. You know why? Because you see some TV stations and they'll be putting like COVID-19 data, like it's like 24/7 on your screen, right? Whenever you're seeing that COVID-19 data, your heart cannot feel right after being exposed to that kind of information, right? So again, I'm just saying this on your own. This is almost like a take responsibility kind of a life lesson. But if you're feeling bad, speak to somebody, but don't spread it online or in a public forum where it can really crush a person, right? Again, here's one way you want to be careful here. I'm not saying you cannot say things in public forums, right? Again, please hear me out, because again, I know this may be a sticking point for some people, right? Like, oh, should I not share my bad experiences online? No. Or should I never share anything online? No. That's not what I mean, right? So say, for example, you're dealing with like a depression, or you're dealing with like just a tough circumstance. Let's say like a person like lost a parent or a close friend or a family member. Absolutely. You should post that online if you need to, right? You should absolutely post that online, right? Because people will be able to commiserate with you, right? I mean, even the Bible says you should rejoice with those that rejoice, right? And you should mourn with those that mourn, right? So as you mourn with those that mourn, right? Like, no, there's no problems. Even like I reach out, right? Or I comment, right? Like when, you know, people pass away online and all that stuff, that's absolutely fine. The specific scenario I'm talking about is like sharing test experiences, right? Where you say, I was guessing, like, again, there's nothing wrong with sharing test experiences where like, oh, like, you know, using UWorld really helped me, or using Ambos really helped me, or using Divine Intervention podcast really helped me, or using this really helped me, or, you know, the MBME really loves that. Oh, like the MBME content outline is a high yield document to study for your exam. Yes, that's absolutely fine. Those kinds of things are helpful to people, right? But when you start saying, I guessed on every other question, this exam I know I'm gonna fail, blah 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 blah. Again, I know you may feel, and again, don't get me wrong, I validate what you're going through, right? I have no doubt you're going through a tough time, because guess what, I also took these exams, right? And I didn't feel the best after taking these exams. But just by not posting those kinds of like, oh, scary, right, you're helping out your fellow man, right? That's one of those reforms I would think that med students, these are things that we can easily execute ourselves, right? So just something to keep in mind, right? Like, there's like a classic biblical example of this. Like, there's like the widow of Zarephath. I think it was the widow of Zarephath, if I'm not mistaken. Again, sorry, I'm giving this off the cuff, right? But this woman, her son literally had just died. Literally had just died, right? And she walked outside of her home and she was telling... someone asked her like, oh, what is going on? And she said, it is well, right? Imagine a person just suffering the loss of your own child, and you're literally using the term, it is well, when people are asking you how things are doing, right? But that woman, what she was trying to do in that circumstance was, she was trying to not be a spreader of bad news. Because again, spreading bad news is just generally not a good thing, right? Because again, it crushes the soul and the spirit of the other people that hear it, right? So, like, again, I also like to give that example of, again, the Israelites, right, as they sent spies to go spy on Canaan before they went into the land of Canaan. What is the thing that happened, right? Some of those spies came and just polluted the minds of the Israelites, right? by just saying things that freak them out, that, oh, we felt like grasshoppers, blah, 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 right? So again, I'm not saying you cannot spread news, right? But just maybe think about the news you're spreading before you spread it, right? Make sure that the words you're spreading are, like, the words you spread are helpful, right? So again, I'm not saying you cannot post exam experiences. But again, that's why, again, I'm being very specific, right? Because again, I don't want people to quote me out of context, right? But posting experiences that, oh, I feel like I guessed on every single question. Again, I'm not saying that's not something you should share, but maybe share it in a smaller space than sharing it in a bigger space that would then freak out people and disturb their mental health, right? Again, look out for your fellow man. Again, in this world, we're not called in this world to, oh, like, oh, look out for ourselves only, right? You should also look out for your neighbors, right? Look out for your neighbors, because if everyone looks out for their neighbor, right, I feel like the suicide rates in this country and in the world will go down, especially amongst healthcare professionals, right? So let's not eat our own young. Let's look out for our own, right? Because again, if we don't look out for our own, as you've seen, many of the powers that be in healthcare don't necessarily look out for the best of each and every one of us, right? So let's look out for our own, right? So again, hopefully this makes sense. Again, I know you may not agree with some of what I'm saying, and again, I'm sorry, right? But I think it's a point that needs to be made, because I feel like that's actually one big contributor to like stress and unwellness amongst medical students and a lot of healthcare professionals. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you in the next one. God bless you. Thank you.